Turning today to the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 25 and verse 1. Acts, the book of Acts, chapter 25, verse 1. Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days, he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem. The subject is the Christian's purpose. This 25th chapter of the book of Acts is often regarded as one of those several chapters in the book which is more of an historical link chapter. And therefore, sadly, there's small expectation of doctrinal or devotional blessing from it. But it's not the case. Though it is something of a linking chapter, there's marvelous insight here into the apostle's purpose. And this is what we shall consider and look at. The commentator, Dr. William Hendrickson, said that Paul's life and character could be seen in terms of 3 significant attributes, given, of course, by the power of God. Humanly speaking, the Apostle Paul had a brilliant intellect. That comes through all the time. Now we know that his words, he is not, of course, the author of Acts. The Acts of the Apostles is about him. The author of the Acts of the Apostles is Luke, the beloved physician. But all Paul's writings, his epistles, it's clear that he's a great intellectual, a mighty intellect. They're given by inspiration of God, but God used the style of the human penman. So, yes, Paul had a massive intellect. But also, he had an iron will, not just stubbornness, but an iron will, a tremendous, an indomitable purpose. Tremendous resolution, determination beyond comparison, what he accomplished, what he went through, how he persisted, what an example he is, was by the power of the Spirit. And unlike many people who have an iron will, he had another attribute that was equal to it, if not greater, and that is an amazingly compassionate heart. Oh, to have an iron will coupled with a compassionate heart, a sensitive person and a person of love and compassion and good works. Surely no mere mortal exceeded the Apostle Paul on this. Well, the Apostle Paul, with his all-consuming mission, he would suffer, it would seem, anything for his Lord and Saviour, Jesus Christ. What drove him? Well, possibly chiefly his sense of indebtedness, his constant memory of what he'd been forgiven, and the outrageous behaviour as a persecutor of God's people that he had been, and how much he'd been pardoned and forgiven. That must have been a powerful driving force. I'd like to read some very familiar verses before we proceed with this chapter from 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23. Are they ministers of Christ? Paul writes, I speak as a fool, I am more, in labours more abundant, in stripes above measure, that is, lashings, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths oft. And he wrote all this before the 2 years imprisonment in Caesarea, which has just come to an end at the beginning of Acts 25. These things that he writes to the Corinthians are all earlier sufferings. Thrice was I beaten with rods, once was I stoned, thrice I suffered shipwreck, a night and a day I have been in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils by mine own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides those things which are without, that which cometh upon me daily, the care of the churches. And all that comes before what we're reading about at the beginning of Acts chapter 25. The Apostle Paul was mightily used by the Lord. At this time, it's been estimated that there must have been between 500,000 and 1,000,000 converts in the Gentile cities where he'd founded churches. And here in Jerusalem, even through the work of the Apostle Peter and others, there were 20 to 40,000 converts. But Paul was the one who was used more greatly than any other. Now, when Festus was come into the province, he became governor, Roman governor of Judea. After 3 days, he'd come all the way from Rome, 3 days in his fortress city in Caesarea, 70 miles northeast of Jerusalem, and he almost immediately ascends from Caesarea up to Jerusalem. He wasted no time. We can suppose that Festus, who replaced Felix had got into trouble. Felix had behaved appallingly as governor of Judea. He'd left Paul in prison, in captivity, in Caesarea for 2 years. But eventually the complaints of the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem were given attention in Rome, and Felix was recalled, and he was subjected to severe reproof of some kind. It's not recorded what. However, he'd returned. His life was saved by his brother, secular history tells us, but Festus took his place. A great difference, by the way, between Felix and Festus. Felix was quite a rough character. He was a Roman, had been born a slave. By various things I won't describe, he'd been elevated and he'd gained his freedom and become quite an important person and eventually governor of Judea. But born a slave, he still was a slave at heart, and he's replaced now by Festus, who's a member of the nobility and altogether more refined as a person. He takes his place. But when he goes as governor of Judea, he knows that one thing he has to do is to placate the Jewish leaders and be more conciliatory to them. He wants to be fair as a procurator, as a governor, and he wants to exercise justice, but he wants to placate them. And this is in his mind. So he speeds to Jerusalem. No doubt he was interested personally in this great religious city. But no sooner is he there, the new governor, that you see old hatreds revived. Verse 2. I'm going to go through in a narrative manner, but try to draw attention to the important things as we go. Then the high priest is now a man named Ishmael, not Ananias, as when the Apostle Paul was accused 2 years earlier. Ananias has been replaced by a man named Jonathan, and he's been replaced by Ishmael. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews, the Sanhedrin council, or at least the Sadducees, who really dominated that council, informed him against Paul. They lost no time. The new governor gets to Jerusalem, and you'd think there were all manner of things that the Jewish leaders wished to raise and wished to press home. But top of the list appears to be the Apostle Paul, and they're after his life, and they want these accusations to be revived. 2 years hasn't dimmed their memories or diluted their hatred one bit. So the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul and besought him. They pleaded with him to act. And this is what they wanted done, verse 3. They desired favor against who? Against Paul. They wished to have the special favor that Paul would be tried at Jerusalem. Well, this was really not in order, holy. It wasn't right. Paul should have been tried. He was in under Roman jurisdiction. He was a Roman citizen. He'd been arrested by the Romans, held by the Romans. He should have been tried at their bar of justice. But they desired that he would be sent to Jerusalem and tried there. But you see why at the end of verse 3, because the Sanhedrin wanted him assassinated on the way. They didn't want him tried. They wanted him dead. And in their evil, there was a plot to destroy him before. As you know, we won't rehearse those things. But now it's the Sanhedrin council themselves. But verse 4, Festus, who was very willing, the text goes on to tell us, to do them a favor and to give way to many of their requests, obviously overruled by the Lord. Festus, who I assume knew nothing about the plot, answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea and that he himself, Festus, would return there shortly, and any of the Jewish leaders who were able, let them, verse 5, attend, go down with the governor, and then accuse Paul at Caesarea. And he warned them. He gave them a sort of failed warning. It's at the end of verse 5. If there be any wickedness in him. And what that really means is that Festus wanted to hear serious charges, real offences, offences against Roman law. That's what he was expecting to hear. What were they going to bring against Paul? A murder, perhaps? Surely not. Fraud, perhaps? Sedition? Well, they would certainly bring that and try to accuse him of raising up people to rebellion, and so on. And these were the kind of charges that the Roman governor wanted to hear. But down in verse 6, when he'd tarried among them more than 10 days, the text says 8 to 10 days, he went down unto Caesarea with the Jewish leaders, presumably, and the very next day took his position in court on the judgment seat and commanded that Paul be brought. So now Paul is going to have yet another trial, this time before Festus in Caesarea, and the Jews are accusing him. And look at what happens. This is the antagonism of unbelief. Dear friends, this is nothing unusual. It happens to the apostle. They hate him. They hate him because of his teaching, of course. They hate him because he doesn't recognize them as godly men. They hate him because he denounces their hypocrisy. He teaches Christ, and Christ denounced their hypocrisy, the leading clergy of the Jewish church of those days. They hate him because he teaches that the only way to secure acceptance with God and the favor of God is by grace, by receiving God's free mercy and forgiveness, by trusting in Christ and what he'd achieved on Calvary's cross in making a substitutionary atonement for the sins of the people who would be saved. Trusting in him, how they hated that message that suggested they, the leading clergy, should repent of their sin and should know a real relationship with God, which they didn't have. And they hated that message. They hated Paul. They hated the message of Christ. They hated everything he taught. And even time could not dim that hatred. Well, because in the background, but I say in the background, this is the mainspring of it, really. In the background is Satan stirring their hearts to hostility, Satan ever trying to destroy the Church of Christ and the message of Christ and the faith and life of Christian people? And so after 2 years, their anger and hatred has only grown, and they're determined to get Paul tried and even assassinated on the way to trial. They cannot assassinate him in Caesarea. It's a fortress town. There are some 5 or 6 legions of Roman soldiers based there, stationed there. It's a garrison town. They can't raise a finger against him there. They don't want him tried there. They want him brought down to Jerusalem, 70 miles of road. Anything can happen on that road. He can be waylaid. He may never arrive. So they want him back. It's remarkable, the history of hostility and animosity against the Church of Christ. It's predicted, of course, in the very first book of the Bible. In the book of Genesis, chapter 3, verse 15, there God tells our first parents of the hostility that there will be, directed at the seed of the woman by the seed of the serpents, and people motivated and driven by Satan, the enemy of souls, will always be antagonistic to the church. That'll be the battle of the ages. So it has been. And you see here in the New Testament the power of God in sending out the gospel, and people in their hundreds of thousands and soon in their millions being converted. But at the same time, the persecution and the hatred and the hostility. Many of those who hate, like Paul, coming themselves to salvation, but still the enemy of souls stirring the hearts of others. There are times in history when this hatred cannot express itself so powerfully. In this country, for example, we had 500 years ago, the beginning of the Reformation, when in this country vast numbers were converted through the preaching of the gospel, and a new organization of church and order came in, and the Reformation rescued the British people from all kinds of depravity, restored to us our mind, our power of reason. We believed in every kind of hobgoblin and foul fiend and spirits of the woods. We were so superstitious before the Reformation came about. And the Church of Rome, with all its errors and false teachings, had plunged this nation and many others into horrific superstition and ignorance spiritually. The Reformation gave us back our souls, gave us back our minds, gave us so much. And then in the following century, in the 17th century, the fruit of the Reformation was seen in the great Puritan movement. It was the great century of theological definitions and confessions of faith. The teaching was so good. Those Puritan pastors, so despised in modern times, were men of such warmth and heart and depth, and people continued to be converted through their ministries. And the whole country was forced and obliged, really, by the power of the advance of the gospel, to recognize the truth and the power of the Christian faith. But then in the next century, as things began to go downhill and the faith began to be rejected, in the 18th century, there's awakening beginning in the 1730s. It was so prolonged, it saved us from an equivalent of the revolution in France. Tremendous change came about in society, and all the truth of earlier centuries was preserved, and a vast proportion of the population were Christian. Do you know about all these things? The successive reformations and revivals of Britain, it's the backbone of English history, British history. People don't know about it today. Do you know why? Well, because we're all programmed not to know about it. It's eliminated from all the syllabuses these days. Very little is known and taught about the mighty work of God through the Christian faith in this land over the years. You must know about these things. You mustn't be told about these things. We're on a downward slope now. And then into the 19th century, mid-century, another mighty outbreak of awakening and revival, and thousands upon thousands of conversions, and everybody influenced, and even the royal family and the rulers of the country have to use Christian language, and everyone respects the ethics of the Bible. And into the 20th century, with its two world wars and its massive rejection of Christianity, people may have rejected faith, but you know, they held on to the Christian ethic and respected that, even if they didn't keep Christian ethics, they held on to them right up until about the 1960s, when the great turnaround came about. And society was told, now you've rejected the Christian faith for your and a relationship with God for your life, why don't you reject Christian morality too? And so the alternative morality that we see in full force today began to be promoted. And no longer did you have to be faithful to your wife, and no longer did you have to avoid premarital sexual experience. And suddenly things that had become horrific and awful up until this time, the whole homosexual upheaval came in, and people began to be programmed and brainwashed by all the powers of media and entertainment into accepting things that people were horrified at before. And us, those of us who are older, we know that 50 years ago, the public attitude was altogether different from what it is now. Why these things couldn't rear their head? The antagonism to Christianity, to faith, to Christian morality, to the standards of the Bible, these things couldn't make headway years ago because there had been such powerful blessing that they were printed on the life of the nation. But now things have been turned around. The great campaign is in. Satan has become free in the last 50 years to promote every kind of opposition to faith and moral principles. Now you see it in the Church of England. What a tragedy it is. Some of the bishops wrote, may I say, a pretty feeble report trying to hold the status quo and keep the whole notion of same-sex marriage out of the formularies of the church. But what they wrote was completely overthrown last week in the Church of England Synod by the House of Clergy. The majority of clergy would rather have give way to homosexual practice than oppose it. Astonishing, but not so astonishing, because this is the Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, the hostility against the children of the woman, the seed of the woman, Christian people, Christian faith, God's standards of morality. That's what it is. It's predicted all the way through the Bible, and in the book of Revelation, it's described as peculiarly typical of the last age, of the very last days before the end of the world, when these standards will be completely overthrown by society. So you see it beginning here. Here it is with the Apostle Paul, undying antagonism. Now Satan is doing his worst today. It'll get worse. It'll become much worse unless there is a mighty revival or awakening in this country before the end. That's what Christians pray for. Whether it is the purpose and will of God, we cannot tell. Whether it will now get worse and worse until the Lord intervenes and returns and there's final judgment. But that's really what, it's the same character as the hostility which is here. It's what people want. It's what people want in their hearts. And Satan will promote it and advance it. But let's come back to the record of what took place here in Acts 25. And I must proceed quickly. Verse 7. When he was come, the Jews which came down from Jerusalem stood round about and laid many and grievous complaints against Paul. Many and grievous ones. The Greek says heavy, serious, weighty complaints, charges against Paul, which they could not prove. Why, they'd had time. Why could they not raise false witnesses? Couldn't they fabricate something? It was not beyond them. It was the kind of thing they did. Why did they produce no witness, no proof of these things? Was their arrogance, dear friends? Those Sadducees, those senior members of the Sanhedrin council with their high priest, they thought just by vehemence of charge and accusation they'd carry the day. And Festus would show them a favor and would give them a corrupt judgment. But no, Festus, though he wished to give them a favor, it was his first trial. He'd only just become procurator or governor of Judea. This was his first trial. He was going to insist that Roman law was complied with. Look here, he thought, you must bring if you bring these charges of sedition, you must have witnesses. Somebody must have heard Paul say these things and inveigh against Caesar and say he wished to bring Caesar down. You can't just lay charges. You've got to have evidence. You say he's profaned your temple and he's gone about the world stirring up the Jews. Well, let's have chapter and verse, something definite. And they hadn't bothered to assemble a prosecution. They didn't bring a Tertullus, a professional operator, on this occasion. And so he was able to answer for himself. Verse 8, and Luke just summarizes it here. He doesn't spell it out in detail. No doubt Paul's defense was much longer than just this simple statement, but this sums it up. Neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor against Caesar have I offended anything at all. He denied it. He demanded evidence. But Festus, verse 9, does an extraordinary thing. Willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, well, wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? What he should have done, but it's a good thing he didn't, what he should have done is acquit Paul. Paul was not guilty. Inadequate evidence was presented. The charges could not be carried. What should the Roman procurator have done? Acquit the accused. And he failed to. And he didn't. But what a good thing. Because if Paul had been acquitted, he almost certainly, but for some other overriding of God, which we can't imagine how it would have taken place, Paul would have been murdered. There were assassins present. How would he ever have left Caesarea, that garrison town? They were ready to murder him on the road before, and they certainly would. He needed, under God, the protection of the Roman troops. So Festus, he doesn't acquit him. He should have done. He does something really rather preposterous and out of order. And he says to Paul, well, Paul, this is more a religious matter than a Roman matter. Will you go to Jerusalem and be tried before the Sanhedrin court? Of course, I will prevail. I will be there. I will be the ultimate judge. But be tried in Jerusalem, where they can put all these complicated Jewish questions that I do not understand. He shouldn't have been doing that. Paul was a Roman citizen who'd been held in his jail. And Paul, of course, says, verse 10, and this is the famous occasion, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat. I'm before a Roman court as a Roman citizen, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong. That's been evident from these proceedings, as thou very well knowest. And he puts Festus in his place. You know well, you should be acquitting me, he almost says. And then in verse 11, he says, in so many words, I am not trying to get out of these offences by some technicality, as you know. So I appeal unto Caesar, his right as a Roman citizen, to be sent to Rome and tried before, not necessarily Caesar personally, though some people were, but before the imperial court, the supreme court, we would say today. So he appeals to Caesar. What made Paul do that? Was it just the realization that he had umpteen assassins out for his life if he were freed? That if he agreed to go to Jerusalem, which was not the right and the proper procedure, he would be murdered on the route, or certainly held guilty and executed once there? Was it just that? Surely he had fear in going to Rome. You know who the emperor was now, the new emperor in Rome? It was Nero. Now he hadn't, it's true, manifested anti-Christian hatred just yet, but it was soon to follow, and there were great fears. If you appealed to Rome and you went before a Roman court, everything was weighted against you because there was general resentment that you should be so troubling the system. And not many people were found not guilty after appealing to Rome. So he had fears either way. What caused him to decide to assert his Roman rights as a Roman citizen, a Jew, yes, but born in a city that gave Roman citizenship? What caused him to appeal to Rome? Well, because God had told him to do it. We've read about that just previously. God appeared to him during the night 2 years earlier, and after he'd defended and spoken of Christ, God revealed to him that he would equally defend himself in Rome and witness to Christ as he did so. So he knew that his future would take him under guard to trial to witness in Rome. So when he was asked, will you go back to Jerusalem? No, this was obviously the way of God. I appeal to Caesar. I'll go to Rome. And then the response of Festus in verse 12. And how beautifully Luke records it under inspiration. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, he obviously had a select council of Roman elders there in Caesarea. This was his very first case. What did he ask the council? I think I know what he asked the council. Do I have to send him to Rome? If he appeals, do I have to send him? He realized at once, Festus, that this was very embarrassing to him. His first case, and there's an appeal, and he sends it to Rome. This is almost failure. Do I have to send him? Yes, said the council. There's no way out. You have to send him to Rome. Well, somebody who'd appealed to Rome, that could be ignored under certain circumstances, but Paul's was not one of them. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council to get out of this embarrassment, no doubt, answered, Hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Isn't this an interesting touch? Unto Caesar shalt thou go. He must say it as though it's his decision. It's his sentence. By his authority, he's sending Paul to Caesar. Of course, he has no option, but he makes his grand declaration anyway. And then, almost at once, you read in verse 13 about something else, and I've got a few moments left to tell you about this extraordinary event, because it casts light on how God arranges opportunities for witness. Here is Paul, a prisoner. He's been tried. He should have been acquitted. But, may I say, fortunately, he wasn't acquitted. Because while he's under guard in Rome, he's under their protection. But he's appealed to Caesar because God has earlier shown him that he must witness to him in Rome. But after certain days, King Agrippa, who's he? This is Agrippa the Second, son of Agrippa the First, who murdered the Apostle James, and who had that terrible death when his bowels burst open and he was eaten of worms. Well, this is his son. He's not a very wholesome character, but he's a ruler of a neighboring Roman territory. He's a Jew, but he's also brought up in Rome, brought up in the household of an evil emperor, Claudius. But now he's ruling a pretty small patch, but it's a neighboring patch. He's a Roman proconsul. After certain days, Agrippa and Bernice, well, that's our classical pronunciation. People bearing this name prefer to be called Bernice today. Maybe that's how I should say it and get with it and get up to date. But that's how we're used to pronouncing it. Bernice came unto Caesarea with King Agrippa to salute Festus. Bernice, by the way, was always rumored in Rome, secular history tells us, that Bernice and Agrippa, they're not husband and wife, they're brother and sister. But the rumors in Rome were always that they had an incestuous relationship, and that's probably true. She was his consort, believe it or not. She was the sister of Drusilla, who we met in the previous chapter. But Agrippa and Bernice came unto Caesarea to salute Festus. And when they'd been there many days, and they'd run out of things to do, and things of interest, and places to visit, and conversation, and all the rest of it, Festus suddenly had a good idea. I know something very profitable we can spend time on. I'm in an awkward predicament. I'm in a corner. I've got Paul here, this Jewish man, and he's appealed to Caesar, and whatever I'm going to say in my notes to Caesar, I've no idea. I don't understand the issues, and I should have acquitted him, and I haven't, and I'm now embarrassed because he's appealed to Caesar. Well, Agrippa is a Jew, and he's an expert in Jewish things, so I'll call him in on this, and that will use up some of his time before he goes home, and perhaps he can compile the letter to Caesar for me. That's what's going on here. Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king, Agrippa. Agrippa was actually junior to Festus. He ruled a smaller region. There is a certain man left in bonds by Felix. It's his fault. Verse 15, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me. They accused him, desiring to have judgment against him. A death sentence. To whom I answered, what a good chap I am, says Festus in verse 16. To whom I answered very splendidly, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die. before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. I laid the law down. I told him about the good law of us Romans. Therefore, when they were come hither without any delay, I dealt with this whole thing expeditiously. I shouldn't be in this predicament. I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth. And he tells his story. And it all turned out to be Jewish wrangling, he says. And he appealed to Caesar. He omits to say, I failed to acquit him. It's my fault. He leaves that out as he speaks to Agrippa. He said, oh, he just appealed to Caesar over my head. What shall I say? What shall I write to him? And that's what he asks. In verse 24, Festus said, King Agrippa and all men which are here present with us, ye see this man. Oh, but how they brought him in. Verse 23, on the morrow, when Agrippa was come and Bernice with great pomp, immense fancy, says the Greek. Why, Agrippa was all dressed up, and so was Bernice. And they all took their place, and the chief captains, the kiliarchs, the colonels, 5 or 6 colonels in Caesarea. That's how many legions there were. A legion's 1,000 men. And principal men of the city. And then, when they were all splendidly arranged, this is the process of intimidation, Paul was brought in. It was supposed to overwhelm him. And Festus makes his little speech. It's an informal hearing. It's not a proper trial. This is all just to entertain Agrippa and so that he would give advice. And I won't proceed into it now, but in the next chapter, you discover what Paul does. We'll study it in due course. He gives his testimony again. He speaks of Christ. How God superintends witness. Paul no doubt prayed for an opportunity to witness to them all. And God gave it to him. A noble, informal trial. A splendid gathering, full robes, everything. Paul brought in. And he addresses Agrippa and Felix, and we'll see their reactions. You can't suppress Paul. We set out by saying the apostle had determination, a great purpose in life. When he prays to witness, God arranges it. He didn't ask. He couldn't set it up. He had no power to do so. But here's a full, noble, splendid turnout of the 2 regional rulers and all the colonels. How many of them might be saved? You know how the gospel went among the Roman forces and throughout the empire? Because people like Paul were given these mighty opportunities. He turned it into an occasion for a sermon, as we'll see. What resolution you and I need. Young people, these are desperate days. These are terrible days. You don't see it. Us older people see, we've seen the brainwashing and the change. We know that 50 years ago, pretty well everybody was against the ideas that are rammed down your throats today. And the anti-morality which is taught today, and the legal measures which are now being brought in, which will penalize believers and people who hold to biblical standards of morality. These things were unheard of years ago. You don't grasp, and I'm not saying this to belittle anyone, it's concealed from you. You don't grasp the turnaround that there's been in society and in government. We'll all pass from the scene if the Lord doesn't come before the full horrors are seen of where society is going. And if you found the Lord, you must stand. You must have determination, resolution, a witness. Don't just wobble into your future lives as though you were not saved. The great thing for me is to get married, to have a good career, to have a family. Well, I hope all these things happen for you and that God blesses you, but don't make them your key things. Here's the example. Your chief purpose is to stand for Christ, to win souls, to do good works, to represent the Lord, to guard these beliefs. You're going to need a grit and determination which my generation didn't require. But you'll need it in the future. It's only the truly saved who will stand in what is surely the last age. God will arrange all your opportunities for witness. He can bring them about in astonishing circumstances. Will we stand for him? Will we stand? That's what this linking chapter reveals to us, the determination of the Christian heart and the Christian mind. Let's close preparing ourselves for the Lord's Supper, singing the hymn 253. Hymn number 253. Extend.